Welcome to the 285th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg Zitkin as host tonight for Johnny, who I'm afraid is otherwise occupied and couldn't make it tonight. But still with me as usual, James Jones.
Hello.
And Miss John Lindemann.
Always a pleasure to hear your dulcet tones, Greg.
Thanks, John. And rejoining us, I guess, from a couple of weeks ago, podcast supremo over at negativeworld.org, Guillaume Veillet.
I will overstay my welcome if you allow me.
Well, John's still here, so.
Yeah. Yes. I think I got you beat on that one.
He was site director and I was trying to get rid of him, so think about that.
Yeah, so unfortunately, Johnny couldn't be with us this week, but we still have quite a lot of show to get to, so we're going to have new business in the first segment as usual, led off by James and all that exciting last story talk that he couldn't get to last week. And then in the second segment, we're catching up on your list of mail, got quite a few there, to see how much we could get through before we all virtually fall asleep in our chairs here. And so without further ado, let's get on with it. James, as I said, you could join us for new business, but at this point you're pretty close to finishing the last story, so I expect a definitive verdict from you.
I am literally in the battle with the final boss of the last story, who is a bastard. That's an ongoing situation, but actually it brings me to, without spoiling that fight, that particular fight brings me to something I'm not sure I touched on much 2 weeks ago. One thing off the record last week that I mentioned was, I said, you know, this game reminds me of another game I played a while ago, and I may have said a Square Enix game. I can't remember if I gave that preface or not, but Johnny immediately shot entirely derisively, "Oh, you mean Crystal Chronicles, the Crystal Bearers?" And my response was, yes, that's exactly the game I was thinking of. Then I quickly realized the repercussions of that and said, but not terrible. It's not really like your average RPG. There's not a big overworld. There's essentially a hub world, and you go to people and you trigger quests, and then you go to a place where your quest takes place. What I could compare it to was a bit like in Monster Hunter, where there's the hub town, and then you say, I'm going to go kill whatevers, and then you're transported to that place where those things are.
Hmm.
Except these are very linear story areas that you're killing things in, as opposed to where you're being raped by a giant Tyrannosaurus with a horn on its face, who spawns little Tyrannosauruses with horns also on their faces and breathes fire.
Yeah, good times.
Actually, what I wanted to touch on a bit was the progression of the game's story.
Well, hang on a minute. Let this just for people... Can't leave it hanging quite that much. It's for people who might be wondering whether or not they've actually played Crystal Bearers for Wii.
Yes.
In what ways does the last story remind you of that game?
It's a bit... To call it an RPG is a bit of a misnomer.
Because that was kind of an action game.
Yeah. With RPG elements. This is more of an RPG. But really, it's very, very much like an action game. I mean, like I said, it's incredibly linear. The only time you really have to branch out is in the hub world, which is just a city and a castle that you can kind of walk around in. And you could do some things there, like you can plant crops, or you can fight in arena battles, or you can hunt down a lost cat. I mean, it's in that respect, it's very much Crystal Bears lineage. But unlike Crystal Bears, you don't have to walk all over the damn map to get to places. Oh, wait, Crystal Bears didn't have a map. You just had to know where you're going. Excuse me, so we didn't have to walk all over the world like Marco Polo, not knowing where things are. So, beyond that, the combat system is kind of this in-game world. When you get into a battle, the area you can traverse kind of locks down. The battles are more or less pre-scripted, so the enemies are in a position before you get there. You can use the environment to your advantage. I mean, it does bear a lot of similarities to the Crystal Bears in that regard. It is, however, a much more cohesive game. It feels much stronger. It's much better thought together. It's much more clearly focused versus the Crystal Bears, which just seemed scattershot.
Yeah, very muddled. That was generally what people seemed to think about
It's just like they tried to cram too many ideas in. And this game actually does do that a little bit. There are times where it starts to put kind of weird things in there. You're just like, what? Like, there's a battle where you have to fight it on horseback, but really you're on the back of a giant monster that plows through enemies. It's like, that was kind of a weird battle. It doesn't really play like the rest of the game, but whatever, it's not a big deal.
In terms of the action and the combat elements that you described, one of the criticisms that I've read in reviews, which were broadly quite positive when it came out in Europe a few weeks ago, but something that sort of resonated with me was the idea that you have a lot of these fairly unusual for a JRPG kind of mechanics and all that in the battle system, but they're not necessarily exploited as well as they might be because in general it's very easy.
Yes. You know,
that basically it's so easy that it doesn't really ever kind of require you to master and really wrap your head around all these concepts. That's fair in your mind for being this deep into the game?
It does, actually. And that's kind of where I was going to head towards on this conversation, is that the average engagement is, I don't know, 15, 20 Garak spawn. There might be some archers, there might be some mages, there might be a healer. And before the battle starts, the game pauses, you get an overhead view of the enemy formation, and you get to make, you know, some very high-level tactical decisions about how you want to handle the fight. Now, in theory, you can start guiding your allies by occasionally giving them commands, saying, like, I want you to use this attack on this enemy, and coordinate your strategies. You can use cover to your advantage. You can try to ambush enemies by hitting them with your crossbow and leading them into a trap. I mean, there's lots of things you can do, but the game doesn't really set you up to do them as often as you would like it to, and to be honest, most of the times you don't need to. Where the game actually does deviate into using these elements, like destructible environments, for example, to its advantage, is that there's a good example of a boss who is particularly difficult to hurt. So you get through the first two stages of him, and then his third phase, he just doesn't take damage. The only part of him that's vulnerable, and the game will tell you this if you go into first-person mode and look at him, is his head, but he's like 30 feet tall, so you can't hit his head. But what if you actually look around the stage, you'll find that in the center of the room, there's this large sword that's just hanging from the ceiling. And what you have to do is lead him under it by using the power that makes enemies follow you around and not your allies, and then have one of your allies shoot the sword with magic and basically pierce the enemy's head with it. Now, I, however, missed with this sword, so I had to beat the crap out of him manually, which is incredibly interminable. But if I had hit him, apparently, it would have done nearly enough damage to kill him, knocked him over, and then I could have jumped on top of him and killed him. But it doesn't use that to its advantage all that much. The only time it's really important are a few boss battles. And in fact, the final boss, it requires you to disarm him, which is incredibly difficult to do, and then use his weapon against him, which is even more difficult to do because he disarms you as well.
One thing that you expressed last time you spoke about this game was that you weren't really sure where the story was going, or, you know, it kind of hadn't necessarily got going yet, even though you'd played it for a fair while. So, I mean, how did that change in the power? You said you was about 9 hours in at that point. In the subsequent hours, has it changed a great deal, or is the narrative not really taken off?
At some point, and it's going to be hard to answer this question without significantly spoiling anything. Actually, the party that I had a party to attend, there's a story mechanic there, right after we recorded that episode, and I saved right after the party, and right after that everything started to change. So literally, I was at the precipice of things happening when I made that statement. But it did take 9 hours of sort of character establishment and setting the scene, and in a way that proves to be beneficial because the characters actually mean something. I mean, there's quite a lot of characters. I mean, there's six party characters plus non-party characters that you meet throughout the game. And, I mean, it does a decent job introducing all of them and explaining why they're there, with maybe one or two exceptions of basically characters that are there for comedy's sake. And they never really explain their history. They're just sort of there. But beyond that, the long setup period has some value later in the game. Like I said, it's a bunch of really short chapters. So the game is like 40 chapters long, but I don't think any chapter is more than 30 minutes. So the story starts to move pretty quickly because each chapter is essentially an element of story. There's a couple quirks in the game that it always feels like they just didn't quite finish it. A good example is the last two or three bosses are all chained together. And usually throughout the game, you're constantly having the autosave go off. So if you die, you just say load your last autosave and it picks up pretty much right before you died, usually. But instead, towards the end of the game, for whatever reason, and I don't know why, what happens is it doesn't autosave at all. There's plenty of save points, it just doesn't autosave. So when I died on the last boss, I said, alright, load my last autosave. And I was jumped like four bosses back. I was like, what the fuck? Come on! So I had to basically quit and reload my manual save because that was a hell of a lot, like 40 minutes closer to where I ended up. But there's lots of little things like that where you just look at the game and go, what happened? How did this get through quality assurance? And it sort of takes you out of the game a little bit because there are so many cool things about this game that these weird one-off quirks just don't make any sense. I mean, I really like the game. It's really good. You know, people in Europe should buy the game now because they can. People in North America should be excited for when XSEED releases it. It's a solid 20-plus hour game. It's got significant storytelling capacity. Its combat system is reasonably fun, although underutilized.
It's one of these things, I think, it's a difficult sort of balancing act where you've got a game that's a heavy narrative focus.
Heavy narrative, yes.
And as you say, it's quite more linear and guided than most RPGs, so they can really kind of control the pacing and all that kind of stuff of how the narrative's presented. And so I don't know whether that makes them a bit conservative about the difficulty, because they fear that, you know, well, if we ratchet it up to a point where people are really going to have to get to grips with this stuff on a higher level,
yeah,
to get past something, that's going to basically necessitate at least a significant portion of the players dying a lot before they kind of up their game enough to get past it. And then that interferes with what we're doing with the storytelling. And so they kind of dial it back. I mean, it just seems like
there is a bit of that, because obviously, I mean, there are quests you can engage in, but a lot of times you go through long stretches of the game where you're not in the hub world. You just don't go there. Now, the game comes up with reasons for which you would encounter merchants who can upgrade your equipment or buy and sell things from you. What the game does do a lot of, though, are these points on the ground where if you use the power of the outsider, it will summon enemies. It's basically an attack. You get to trigger an attack from enemies. And
this is the closest thing to grinding in this game.
Yeah. I mean, you're literally triggering an attack from a series of enemies. And one of the things about the game that's interesting is that you gain levels really quickly. I mean, I got stuck outside of a boss. I probably could have beat him if I just worked on my tactics a little bit, but it was just so close. I didn't really want to mess with it. So I hit the button. I fought 3 battles and everybody leveled up, the whole party. The battles didn't take very long at all. And then I had enough money I could turn around and upgrade some equipment too. So I was able to go in there and get that little edge I needed. Usually you're a handful of levels behind the boss, and that's okay. I think the reason the combat is kind of easy, though, is more to do with the fact they didn't do a very good job balancing it. The fact that your character you control, you can attack in multiple directions based on which way you're using the nunchucks analog stick. Which way you're pointing determines how you're attacking. It makes it really easy to juggle multiple enemies at once.
Well, I must say, for me, the difficulty issues do throw up something. Because it seems that you haven't got the exploration kind of focus of something like Xenoblade. So what you are relying on really is the narrative and the action. And for me, I'd probably be looking at it purchase wise as an action proposition.
Right.
And the challenge is always something that I just find it more rewarding if that's there.
I will say, in the game's defense, though, it does build an exceptional world. It's just not, I mean, there's lots of diversity in it, and there's a lot of times you'll walk into an area and go, okay, this is really awesome. It's just that you're guided through the world. It's not.
Yeah, you go on a sort of tour of it rather than exploring it. Yeah.
It's, I mean, there are scenes that look right out of like Lord of the Rings. There are scenes that look like out of sci-fi movies. I mean, you just walk into these places and you're just sort of given the grand tour of the island. And that's fine, and you get to see lots of really cool things for it, but there's never that feeling like, I found this place, even when the characters literally did find this place. Like, like when the story is explicitly saying that they're the first people to have walked in here in, like, 10 generations, and nobody's remembered this existence. Like, well, yeah, I didn't really feel like I found it, though. It was just sort of here. But, I mean, it's cool. It's a fun game. It has some issues, but all in all, I'm happy I've played it.
Very well. All right. Well, we'll move on now to Guillaume. You've been playing quite a bit of different stuff, so why don't you?
Sure. One game I have been playing as part of a game club, actually, on Negative World, is Fire Emblem Path of Radiance. But from the comments that I see on your podcast, like, people leave comments about, like, oh, great, they're talking about a strategy RPG again. That's awesome.
It's more retroactive specific, though, isn't it? The track record of putting them in a poll, meaning they instantly win. I'm not sure they've ever lost. I think it's more that. I don't think anyone would begrudge you talking about it.
No, I think it's because they get into these incredibly nuanced discussions.
Yeah, exactly, because we're obliged to go very deep in retroactive because it's going to be a whole segment and all that sort of thing, so you have to get into the minutiae of it and all that, which could be a bit impenetrable.
I literally hosted an Ogre Battle masterclass on that episode. It was ridiculous.
You really did.
But in other words, I'm relieving you of any obligations to get into that sort of depth as it relates to Fire Emblem Path of Radiance.
Yeah, well, yeah, I still don't want to really elaborate too much on it. It's got a few things that are different from Sacred Stones that I like. For instance, well, you can forge weapons, which can be very, very useful when you're trying to level up weak units. Sometimes they come in and they get killed easily and they don't do a lot of damage. But if you get them an enhanced weapon that you've forged, then it's really easy for them to get the kill and to level up, and it really gives them an edge that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Ba-dum-tsh.
And forging weapons costs more money than it would just buying weapons, but this game gives you so much gold that it's really never a problem. And even your advanced units can really benefit from those weapons. So the only drawback is that you can only forge one weapon per mission. So as soon as you get that ability, you know, I suggest to use it as much as you can and give a weapon of each type. And at some point, you're going to want to create like silver weapons that are really, you know, for the later levels. There's a few things that I don't like, I suppose. I immediately turned off the battle animations because the GameCube has to load a little bit each battle. And that makes all the difference in the world. And like an hour long mission takes 20 minutes when you turn them off. So.
Well, I mean, I always get to that point with those sorts of games, Advance Wars, Fire Emblem, even if obviously, you know, with the old cartridge-based ones, it'd be, you know, smoother than that. But
yeah, sure.
You know, I like to see them for a while, but then especially, you know, as they tend to do, the missions get increasingly long and complex.
Yep.
It's just not something you really want kind of bogging down the experience at that point.
Yeah, but I still turn them off much more quickly than I usually do because there's, you know, the game is not a looker. Characters are not that detailed, and even though like it's definitely more detailed than on a handheld, I mean it does benefit from being in a console, but you can see that it's small budget and everything. But yeah, like playing Fire Emblem gave me a little bit of nostalgia for Advance Wars, and so I decided to go back to the only Advance Wars that I haven't beaten yet, and it's Days of Ruin.
So did you play this, you know, when it came out to some extent, and you've just been away from it for a long time, or, you know, how did that work?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Actually, I should have prepared that, but I looked at the previous save file that I had, and it dated back to 2008.
So it was when it came out originally?
Yep.
Is there any particular reason you could put there for why you didn't beat it at the time and it's been so long?
I think it might have been just simply a strategy burnout. You know, I had played a ton of Dual Strike, and yeah, like it's just fatigue, and the game didn't seem as fun to me. You know, like there's a complete change of tone to the game. Well, complete. It's still pretty goofy.
Yeah, don't let the post-apocalyptic setting fool you altogether. There's still some wacky stuff going on in Days of Ruin.
Sure, sure. But instead of being the characters being all, "Hey, war is fun," they're all, "I'm emo. I'm emo, and war is terrible. But I do what I must do because someone has to do it." And duty and all that. So yeah, there's definitely a change of tone, and like the flashy presentation is still there, but again, complete change of color palette, and I don't know. I guess maybe it's subliminal or something. Like it's just a little bit more dreary.
It's certainly that, although, I mean, for me, when I played it, I'm indifferent as to the presentation. The presentation of Advance Wars in the first place, you know, when I played Dual Strike, or going back to the GBA one as I did later, it's sort of inoffensive, you know, not unpleasant, but just bear through the experience for the most part. Is it something that's important to you, or is it mostly the strategy element?
Yeah, well, like, I used to like the strategy element, but I'm starting to wonder if I've changed as a gamer. Like, I seem to have less patience now for Advance Wars. Like, this kind of tank rush that always seems to happen in all of these games is really starting to get to me. Like, I feel battles drag on a little bit, and at some point it's just a war of attrition, and you're just trying to kill a little bit, like a few more enemies than he kills of your units, and you're trying to produce a little bit more units, and...
So it's real war.
Well, yeah.
War never changes.
Yeah. And at some point, like, the whole rock, paper, scissors aspect of the game seems to, you know, go out the window, and it's really just unit against unit, and you're trying to kill him before he kills you. And the end of battles are always anticlimactic. They always seem to end, you know, just because, oh, okay, finally the balance is tipped, and now...
You feel like the battle was kind of really decided quite a while before that, but this is just the sort of inexorable thing.
You just wind up chasing somebody all over the map and then finally killing him.
It's been a while since I've played Days of Ruin, or Dark Conflict, as it was called in Europe, but I mean, I felt it was quicker than Dual Strike in a number of ways, the way the combat played out, because it wasn't so much emphasis on the CO powers kind of stuff. They weren't as powerful. They couldn't swing the battle as much. It was a sort of purity to it, and it was kind of streamlined in certain areas. And you had a few new units. You had the guys on motorbikes for quicker capture. So right. That part of the, as he said, like, a big part of how quickly you can make units is your resources, and a big part of resources, how much territory you've got. And that part of the game can play it very slowly because you're capturing them with infantry people who are very slow. But then you put them on motorbikes, they're quicker, and that part of the game plays out more quickly. So that was something that I liked about it relative to previous Advance Wars that I'd played. But certain battles can be very finely balanced, and it takes quite a while before you do get that turning point. And then even after that turning point, perhaps it can then take a long time to play out to its actual conclusion. But at least when it's on a handheld, you can kind of leave it for a while if it's really becoming bothersome to stick with it.
Yeah, at some point you're just trying to get your units on top of his factories so that he literally can't produce any more units, and you're trying to finish him off that way. I've never really managed to do a lot of victories by taking his command center. It seems like it's an option that's there, and you would think, like, if you want a quick way to end the match, you should do that. But since they're always surrounded by factories, it never seems to be a good option.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's also risky, too. I mean, you don't want to do that because you put yourself out there to have him come around and take you out.
But, well, the big thing that you want to, if you use units that are obviously just the infantry, but you've got to get them out there somehow, obviously. But, you know, if you can use units that are very dispensable, then it creates a big distraction that they have to deal with. And therefore, you can make advances elsewhere while they're having to fend off the fact that you are trying to capture their command center. That's usually how it goes. You can't actually take it, but attempting to take it could give you advantages elsewhere on the battlefield.
That's true. But other than that, like, I don't know, I find myself not really wanting to take my time with the game. I would be trying to get S ranks for every mission, and I would try to do all of the side missions. But this time I'm just trying to finish the story as quickly as I can, just to say, okay, finally I beat the game. Hmm. And another game that I've been playing recently, it's a PSN game. I've been in a shooter kind of mood lately, the good side-scrolling kind. And so I had Solnir X2 in my backlog, so I fired that up on a night that I was procrastinating going to bed. And, you know, I just wanted to shoot stuff, and that game definitely provides that. Lots of explosions. Another thing that the game does well is that the ship is not crippled at the beginning. Like, it's not going at a snail's pace. Like, it does have decent weaponry.
So does it actually have speed-up power-ups, or is it just that it starts off at a reasonable level?
Well, there is one speed-up power-up, but just in general, you can get around the screen pretty fast. Like, fast enough to deal with whatever enemy has just popped up, you know, at the top when you're at the bottom, you know?
Yeah.
And the game looks good in general, so it's got all those things going on for it. But there's certain design flaws. I hesitate to call them design flaws because it seems like perhaps, you know, a more skilled gamer would not find them flaws. But there are a few things that made me delete the game after a while because I thought, like, there's no way I can stick with it.
Is space on your PS3 so scarce that you had to delete it, or is it an act of aggression against the game for being so inhospitable?
That is kind of harsh.
I upgraded to
voting it off the PS3 island.
I upgraded to a 500 gig disk drive, so space was not an issue. It was definitely... the issue was that I wanted to stop playing, and I couldn't stop myself from playing, so I decided, okay, like, okay, let's drop this.
I don't really know what to make of that. I mean, is that good or bad? Does that mean
game
was...
the opposite of you. I mean...
It is the opposite of Johnny, as games that, you know, could be... You know, to another person, their siren songs would be this horrible cacophony coming from his shelf, driving someone mad, and John's just there like he's got earplugs in, loving it.
Ah, they look great on the shelf, don't they?
Well, let me try to explain.
Explain yourself.
The game has a story mode and challenge mode where you complete, various missions. The problem is that the mission mode, you have to unlock the later levels, and you don't even do that by playing... Well, you do that by finding medals hidden in each level.
So is this kind of Star Coin-Z in a shooter?
Kind of, yeah. You have to shoot certain glowing enemies. Not all of them will have a medal, but, you know, they'll always be glowing when they have a medal. And you just have to know exactly in the level where they are and pick up the medal and unlock the later levels. So that's a little bit annoying. And then there are challenges that allow you to unlock different weapons, and the challenges are very obnoxious. Basically, they'll ask you, like, go through the entire game and get a B ranking or better. Or get through the entire game and max out one of your weapons. And I timed how long it takes to get through the entire game, and it's 53 minutes.
Yeah, it's a pretty long game.
It is ridiculously long. And, you know, like, it would be one thing if you only had to do one mission in those challenges and, you know, you would be done with it pretty quickly. But when you fail again and again and it takes 53 minutes to get there and to even know, like, if you're going to pass it or not, that's just not good design, in my opinion.
So do you think this is a shoot 'em up that's too conscious of wanting to extend its life? You know, obviously in the past, the way that you made people's play experience longer was by making them extremely difficult. Mm. But here we've got, you know, different, you know, achievement type stuff, hidden type stuff, which, you know, on the one hand is nice to have a more nuanced kind of way of encouraging replays or getting better at the game in different ways. But at the same time, it sounds like the problem here is that it's kind of hiding a certain amount of the content of the game behind these kinds of walls, which is not something you associate with the genre at all, is it?
No, and like there's no, like, if it was actually like the intention of the developer to extend the life of the game that way, like, there was really no need. The game has online leaderboards and the game is plenty long enough without challenges that ask you to go through the entire thing again and again. No, I think it's more of a case that they didn't really know what they were doing. Another evidence of that, like, would be that you have to select a specific challenge to attempt it.
Right, so it's not like achievements in that, okay, whatever, if you just do it, it's bing, it's done. You actually have to dedicate, so I am setting out to do this particular one, otherwise it doesn't count.
Exactly. So if you select a challenge where you max out your weapon over the course of the 7 levels and you don't die in doing so, you don't get the credit for not dying. So, yeah, it's a little bit too obnoxious. And that's why I had to make myself stop playing. Like, I you know, sometimes, like, you have this compulsion to unlock everything. Like, the best power-ups are hidden away and you want to unlock them and you keep playing, but it was just too time-consuming.
So is there anything else that you'd like to talk about before I move on to John's new business, which is shooter-related?
No, that's pretty much what I've been playing.
Okay, so John, this glorious shooter rampage that we're on.
Yeah, I picked up a game called, now I'm probably going to butcher this, but this is in Latin, so I'm teaching.
Highbrow.
Highbrow. It's Sine More, which is Latin for without delay.
And to tell you how highbrow it is, it's developed by Grasshopper.
Which means it's full of dick jokes.
Yes, yeah, they actually, it's actually a Hungarian company that did the game programming, but Grasshopper did the concept art and the sound design. So in terms of the look of the game and the sounds in the game, it's very grasshoppery, kind of a stark...
High contrast.
Yeah, high contrast, you know, like roses and, you know, the look of the game, it's very obviously grasshopper.
But does it extend, is there anything that extends beyond the some of those aesthetic elements, or from that point on, is it pretty much just a shooter?
It's pretty much just a shooter, but it does, it's actual art design, like, actually within the game itself. And just to be clear, this is a 3D backgrounds, 2D shooter. So, you know, you're on a 2D plane, but there's 3D backgrounds with, you know, enemies coming out of the background and the camera angle changes. Very, very good looking game.
And is this just on XBLA or is it on PSN as well?
It's published by Microsoft Game Studio.
Right, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, it was originally slated to be on PS3, it got canceled though. But the whole kind of hook of the game is that you go through and you earn time by killing enemies. And you can die by getting hit by enemies, but you're dying because you run out of time.
Yeah, see, it's deducting time off you if you get hit.
Correct. So it's very much like a checkpoint kind of thing, but you, like, cause there are points in the game, like when you defeat a boss, you get more time. Like your time kind of resets, your time checkpoint resets. And, you know, as you go through and you kill more enemies, you might get, you know, a +2 to your time or a +5. And there's an overall theme of time. Story is brought to the forefront. There's a whole lot of story. There's a lot of text that you got to read that's all voiced over. Apparently it's voiced over in Hungarian, which is very strange. So what I wound up doing was I wound up turning the sound down for all of those and just reading through the text and going through the stage.
So is it all in those little interstitial bits between stages, or is some of it like more Star Foxy playing over while you're shooting stuff?
It's a blend of both. There's no like moving avatars like there are in Star Fox, but what you'll have is when a stage begins, there'll be kind of the intro text that you read, and it talks about, you know, yes, these guys killed my son, and so now I'm going to go get revenge. But it goes into a lot more than that. It's actually quite wordy. And then when the stage actually begins, it'll show a couple of different characters, and it'll have their icon there, and it'll show, you know, them talking back and forth between each other.
One thing I was interested about when you talk about the whole the time element is, does it make you play it differently in a substantive way? Do you find yourself more aggressively killing enemies, or does it amount to the same thing as just like, well, in Gradius I've got to kill enemies to get power-ups or whatever other shooter you'd name?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, really it takes you out of just playing defense, which sometimes you can do in certain shooters.
Well, I guess in the Gradius example, what would happen is, once you power yourself up, which could take a long time, you know, you got to get all your options, your shield, your best laser, whatever. But at that point, you can pretty much just concentrate on dodging and killing stuff kind of incidentally. I guess it does insure against that.
The thing is, I mean, in those types of shooters, you don't necessarily gain anything by attacking.
Although, I mean, sometimes killing enemies in those sorts of shooters is defensive from the point of view that the quicker you kill them, the less time they have to spew bullets on the screen. It still has that kind of advantage. So that's why I'm kind of wondering, you know, if it really does make a difference here, that it's sort of more explicit incentive.
Yeah, well, it would change the way you played in the sense that you have more, it's in your best interest to clear an entire screen of enemies.
And how does that come in with boss battles, actually? Because, I mean, are there certain bosses which, you know, you might end up taking more risks in terms of, you know, trying to kill them quicker because you haven't got much time? And therefore, if you came to it with more time because you've done better in the early part of the level, you can now actually be more conservative and have a better chance of killing the boss.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of times where I just... It's especially hard when you first face the boss and you're not exactly sure, you know. I mean, they make it fairly obvious of what you have to shoot.
Destroy the core. It can be more obvious.
Destroy the core. Well, and also there's like kind of like R-type, you know, big ship kind of thing to it, because what you'll do is you'll come up against an enemy that's like a few screens high, and what you'll do is you'll kind of wind your way around it. You'll blow up a couple of things on this side of it, and then the camera will pan out. Your ship will fly around it. And then you'll shoot everything on the other side. So yeah, I mean, it does affect the fact that, you know, always in the back of your mind that if you're not constantly killing something, you could very well run out of time. So it definitely kind of pushes you forward. And, you know, with some of the bosses, you kind of have to figure out exactly what you have to shoot in order to squeeze the most time out of them to allow yourself to enough time to really complete the entire boss round, if you will.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of the art style, it's sort of steampunk mixed with Metal Slug a little bit. Like a lot of the planes are, you know, World War II type of plane with strange changes to them. Like one has a huge pistol on top of it, it's very grasshoppery. And I mean, the game is an homage to a lot of the, I mean, they've said as much that the game is an homage to all of these different, you know, shooters over the years, like Star Fox and Einhander and all of these kinds of games where that they just loved. And so it takes all those and kind of mashes them up. The one other thing you can do is you can also slow time down. So you can kind of use that. You have a meter that I think you only have a set amount of, you know, slow down that you can actually use over the course of a stage, which also helps you because it saves time because you're not getting hit.
Well, some of those mechanical sort of innovations are kind of interesting to me, but of course, if I did have an Xbox, I'd be spoiled for choice, wouldn't I?
Yes.
alas, I don't.
But no, I mean, overall, it's a good game. I mean, it's very solid.
Nice. Well, good to know I'm not the only person here that likes a good shooter. I do have some shooter sort of related new business myself. This week, over the past couple of weeks, I've basically been playing the entirety of the Kid Icarus franchise.
Not the whole two games?
three games, because Uprising did come in today, which is a day earlier than its official release date. And so I've got to play the first three levels of that today, so I'll kind of lead off with the hot new thing, which is Kid Icarus Uprising. And so, I can't really go too much into detail yet. I'm not going to pass judgment on it, just for the first few levels. But
pass all your judgments.
I mean, first of all, just everyone else, all the other regulars on this show has demonstrated pretty much zero enthusiasm for this game in the build up to its release. Having played the demo that I did at the London E3 event last year, I mean, I shared some of that trepidation because I didn't get on very well with the ground-based stages. But, you know, waiting for reviews and seeing some of those come in, you have to realise, I am a huge fan of stuff like Sin and Punishment, so I was always kind of biased towards giving it a go if people thought those bits were really good. And pretty much all the reviews seem to like those. So, you know, I'm willing to risk maybe not liking the ground stuff if they kind of deliver.
You basically Star Fox Armada'd this.
Yeah, it's funny because I didn't risk that, actually. But that was during the import day, so it was more expensive to procure relative to Kid Icarus now. I've just played the first few levels now and very much confirmed what the obvious stuff about the game. The graphics are astonishing, really. I think during the on-rail sections, they're so good looking. It's incredible. The 3D effect is very striking, especially as you're kind of changing speeds as you're going along. You really get that sense of changing speed as you go along. And then all the different environments and all that. I mean, that's really, and this is early in the game, and I haven't necessarily been playing on the highest intensity with the whole weird gambling difficulty slider thing that's
so
going
weird
on there. But not that much going on yet. There's enemies, they're sort of twirling and shooting at you not too quickly, you know, so as long as you keep moving and, you know, are not terrible at aiming, you know, then these sections have not been all that difficult to get through. So the main thing about them has been they're very pretty. And then the soundtrack as well, very, very impressed with that so far. Unsurprising, perhaps, because it seems like Sakurai's got half of the Brawl team back together.
Yep.
With some of the biggest names in the video game composing kind of scene, contributing different tracks, all that. You know, it's got the full cinematic vibe going on, and it's channeling the old games. All that all sounds great. And then there are the controls to contend with, which, so far, what I'm doing is I'm playing the way I played Metroid Prime Hunters, which is, you know, I'm alleviating this discomfort factor of, you know, having to grip the whole system with one hand, support it with one hand at the same time as, you know, using the circle pad and the shoulder button. So, you know, I'm alleviating that discomfort that would come from that naturally by just resting it on my leg and that was, you know, not a perfect solution, but it was sort of workable.
I thought the game came with the stupid stand.
It does come with the stand. I'm not going to use that because how often am I near a desk? But we do actually have an email about the stand, so we'll get to that later on. But that worked fine for me with Prime Hunter, so I thought, you know, it can work fine for me here. And that part of it, the discomfort factor is not too bad. I mean, obviously, the main thing is you will start to feel it. I think for me, keeping that left shoulder button depressed for big periods of time does start to wear on you just a little bit, you know, and I could feel like if I'd kept playing it for longer, it probably would have been more of a problem. But it's a portable game. The levels aren't particularly long. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, I don't think it has to be that much of a problem. I especially think, you know, if you're not reviewing the game, if you're not trying to blow through it in a condensed period of time because you've got to meet a deadline, I don't necessarily see that it's going to completely wear out your hand. But in terms of the efficacy of the controls, in terms of what it's offering you so far, I'm not there yet. I'm not totally comfortable. Some of it's just because it's so kind of unnatural, the stuff on the ground. I mean, in the air, it's fine. You know, you move around with the circle pad and then you just adjust your aim using the stylus and it kind of transposes you from the lower screen to the upper screen. Pretty quickly, you can get very comfortable with that. And your aim is shifting with a sort of fluidity and precision that certainly is much better than it would be if you were using an analog stick to do it. But then on the ground, because, you know, it's not fixed view anymore and you've got to swipe the touchscreen to go, as they refer to it, as sort of like spinning a globe, to actually go from just moving the cursor around to actually shifting your view. That discontinuity is not something I've kind of resolved yet in a dependable way. It does seem like what you have to do, like I said, sort of swipe the touchscreen, and then at the moment that it reaches the sort of view that you want, you tap it again to stop it, to hold it in place right there. And so I started to feel just at the end of my play session today like I was getting the timing of that down. So it's like, okay, well, I want to kind of rotate the view about 90 degrees. So if I swipe it this hard and then tap it this long after, then I can go back to shooting. And it started to get more fluid, but that's a fair amount of skill involved in that alone. But at the same time, it does offer you the ability to target a bunch of different stuff that's around you very quickly, again, with greater kind of fluidity and precision than it would if it were dual analog to some extent. But it's just, at this point, it's still difficult for me to actually do that. So it kind of feels like the controls are not natural at all. But on the other hand, I could see maybe if you master them, they would actually prove appropriate. But the one thing I will say is just superficially, it does seem like the game would be better suited to Wii from a control point of view. I mean, if you look at Sinner Punishment 2 and RE4 Wii Edition, I think it's the two gameplay styles have been proven to control very well.
It actually reminds me of, what's that Japanese game? Rodea the Sky Soldier. I mean, kind of wonder why this is a 3DS game besides they needed a 3DS game.
Well, I think it's a 3DS game because I think something that Johnny always says, he said just recently about the whole thing about reviving franchises, is that a lot of the time, it's if you're either reviving a franchise or you're creating a new one, the time to do it is at the start of a system's life.
So a year ago.
Well, yeah, well, exactly. That's the problem. They've even kind of missed...
It's a Wii U game now, guys.
They've kind of missed that a bit with... Although, because the 3DS started slow, it's almost like its life really started at the end of last summer. So maybe it's not quite
six
so bad
months late
in that regard. But the point stands that if you're going to give this rebirth of the franchise a fair shot, you're better off doing it at the sort of early period of 3DS's life than you are at the end of the Wii's life. And certainly if you look at the state of the Wii software market, indications are if you released it on that, even if it was the same game, even if it was arguably a better game because of controls, it would have sunk without a trace. So it may well be that this is a bit of a, you know, square peg in a round hole because of the commercial considerations and all that, but I'll wait and see how much more I can get. You know, it definitely is a bit to get sort of acclimated to. You're not going to do that in a day. But other than that, I've been playing the other Kid Icarus games. So they had the 3D classics. They promoted it slightly differently. The NES game as a 3D classic over here, you could get it in January if you bought some other Club Nintendo eligible games. Rather than within the States, this is a pre-order bonus, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've had it for a while, didn't really get into it for quite a while, and then eventually I sort of managed to really get going on it, and I actually completed it recently. So it really is what everyone says it is, in terms of it's way harder at the beginning. The difficulty curve is upside down. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And a lot of it, where that sort of breakthrough point comes from, is that the game has this peculiar leveling sort of system that's not terribly transparent, where it's really about how much score you accumulate at the end of each stage. So you do really have to kind of grind and beat enemies and stuff, and then sort of bank that at the end of the stage. And then that will contribute to having a longer life. But the problem is early on, your life bar feels so short that you're kind of just struggling to survive. And so you're not hanging around these additional kill rooms to kill extra enemies to accumulate more score. You're just kind of doing enough to scrape by because your margin of error is so little. But the problem is if you keep doing that indefinitely, you know, you'd be very slow to actually level up at all. So for me, there was a critical point where eventually, you know, I kind of did a level, a run through where, you know, I did actually kill a fair amount of stuff on the way through, extend the life bar a bit. And then all of a sudden, you've just got that leeway to say, well, maybe I will take on this extra kill room. You know, you've just got that bit of extra flexibility, and then you start leveling up more. And then the game just becomes easier. And especially the vertical sections are significantly harder than the horizontal section that you've got. The second level is a side-scrolling thing, which is far easier because in the first level, what happens is it just scrolls up. And it's like original Super Mario Brothers in that once it scrolls up, it does not scroll back down. And if you fall, you die. That's it. So once you get past that first vertical world, you can't die so easily in that side-scrolling setting. And that means you're far more likely, again, to build up a nice score, bank those, and then power up. And then once you get to the next vertical, but the third level is again a vertical sort of shaft world, if you like, then it doesn't seem so hard because you've got a bit of leeway with your stats. And the other thing is that the 3D Classics mode does actually have a few little refinements to make it a bit easier. Because if you hold down the jump button, his descent is slowed. So say for instance, if you did have a bit of an errant jump that might result in you dying in one of these vertical levels, well, you've got more ability to correct that if you can slow down the descent and finesse it and land where you want to. So in that sense, they've made it a little bit more playable with the 3D Classics version. And so eventually, you know, I just got to push through that barrier and then went all the way to the end. And I did quite enjoy it. It's not great. I think it's a bit lacking in the level design area in particular. The dungeons parts, which kind of are the culmination of all the different worlds, you seem like they're mostly there to waste your time. I mean, obviously it's a bit Zelda-esque, it's like a maze, basically, a bit like original Zelda. But it does have a map, but it's in three parts. You have to get the map, then you have to get the pencil to show which rooms you've actually been in, and then you've got to get the torch to actually show where you are currently. And you have to find all these pieces in different rooms in the labyrinth. So, you know, all these things that just take extra time before you've even got your bearings. And then you've got stuff like the eggplant wizard, which, you know, turns you to an aubergine. And then you have to waste your time finding a room to cure you before you can proceed again. You know, that's generally what they're doing, is kind of extending the game. I didn't really care for those too much. You've got to kind of push through it. I mean, it'd be a lot easier if you could just look at a map. You know, obviously, in the old days, you would have done that with Nintendo Power. Now you could just go on GameFAQs or whatever. That's certainly an option. But then I've also played, which I don't think is out in America yet, but the Game Boy game on Virtual Console of Myths and Monsters, or whatever it's called, which was apparently developed by Tosei. We actually know they developed this, despite their ninja developer status.
Interesting.
But at first glance, it seems like a very similar situation as, you know, You had Metroid and Kid Icarus coming out at the same time on NES. You get Metroid 2 and another Kid Icarus game coming out at a similar time on Game Boy. And similar to Metroid 2, it's like, well, it's much chunkier, but that does present visibility issues with the screen. But it's not as bad as Metroid 2.
Yeah, Metroid 2 is horrible.
It's really bad in that regard. This is not as bad as that. But with this, there's a few things that are different now. First of all, it scrolls in all directions. Under any circumstances, so there's no more falling off the bottom of the screen and dying because of that. It'll just scroll down. So it's more forgiving in that regard. Even though structurally it's exactly the same, you know, that's the thing. I mean, Metroid 2 is a completely different game from Metroid. This is essentially an alternate version of Kid Icarus with, you know, a number of changes. But at the same time, it is still a vertical world, a horizontal world, a vertical world, and a final world. It's precisely the same structure. And you have the dungeons are pretty much the same. The leveling works the same. The only other thing is that in that game, they actually had a similar mechanic of being able to slow Pit's descent, which is very important here because you can't see that much below you, so you're going to want to take it slow in case you crash into something that's going to take away your health. So it is a little more forgiving in that way, and so I think it doesn't necessarily take so much effort to kind of push through that early phase of the game as it does with the NES one, so in that sense maybe it's a better bet, but then it's certainly not as visually attractive, I think, as the 3D Classics one, because that does add backgrounds, of course, and so it looks kind of nice, the NES 3D Classics, whereas this right. obviously is on the black and white Game Boy, so it looks nice enough for an early Game Boy game, but it's nothing special. The biggest advantage I would say it's got, though, the Game Boy game, is that the bosses are significantly better. The bosses in the NES game are kind of, their attack patterns are very basic. There's just not a lot going on there. Here, definitely the patterns are more sophisticated. They can be horrifically bullet spongy if you've not leveled up very much up to that point or something. It can get a bit protracted as a result. But I think the bosses being that much better definitely make the dungeon sections that precede them feel a bit more warranted. Like, you know, they build up to these bosses, you know, in the NES game, and then it always feels like a bit of a damp squib. It's kind of difficult to give one the edge or the other because they're so bloody similar, and just one's maybe slightly better in some ways. The NES game definitely has better music, far more memorable. I don't know whether I'd advise playing both of them necessarily. Maybe just pick the one that sounds like the one you'd prefer and just go with that. I mean, for me, I spent a combined £2.70 on playing both of them, so I don't really regret it. But it's been interesting playing what are basically two different takes on exactly the same thing really close together. I've never done that before. I have such a direct side-by-side comparison. But if nothing else, it's prepared me for all the silly in-jokes in the incessant chatter in the new game. All right, well, that's going to do it for new business. And in the second segment, we'll be getting more of your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
It's a big week for 3DS reviews on NWR this time, as we begin with Kid Icarus Uprising, reviewed by Neil Ronahan. We can give him hell for saying it so much, but Pitt was right, we weren't ready yet. And next up we have Pro Evolution Soccer 3D 2012 by the Anfield Cat himself, JP Corbin. Is Konami's second 3DS soccer outing a worthy update?
Props to Greg for getting out to the Pro Evolution before we get any digs in on Kid Icarus. Nicely done. we have a duo of 3DS related rhythm reviews. First we have an import review of Rhythm Thief and the Emperor's Treasure by Danny Bivens. And he asked if you would enjoy a sword fight with Napoleon in Paris. Well, dancing in Paris. Because that's how you should sword fight while dancing.
It's just so right that you had to read that, James. It really is.
I don't even want to know why it's right. Just keep that to yourself. But we have an even more important review here.
Breaking.
For the 3DS eShop.
Alert.
Zombie Slayer Dio, which is a zombie slaying rhythm game. Not to be confused with a rhythm slang zombie game by Neil Ronahan. He didn't make the game, he wrote the review.
All right, now on the feature front, we have Making of a Myth, the Grueling Development of the Original Kid Icarus by Devin Monins, who says, think Pit's climb out of the underworld is tough? Try developing a game by yourself.
Pass.
And we also have another feature, Fave 5 Mario Power-Ups by Andrew Brown. Says, if only mushrooms had the same effect in real life.
Oh.
Well, I suppose that would depend on the mushrooms you're eating, Andrew.
We finish off now playing this week with a blog, the Xenoblade Chronicles North American Unboxing, in which Neil points out that it's real Nintendo of America was not pulling an elaborate and especially cruel prank.
Oh no, they did! The punchline was just that it's out now.
There you go. That's just a sampling of all the original content that's been on NWR over the past week. So make sure you go over there to check out all that, plus the latest news and screenshots, videos, etc. at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. We're now going to get into your listener mail. So, of course, for all future correspondence, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And with that, we're going to get into this week's batch. So, James, you have the first one.
I do have the first one, and it's from Danny. Danny writes, hey guys, I'll cut to the chase. I'm scared for the Wii U. I feel that Nintendo has lost their momentum in the console race. Xbox 360 and PS3 have great technology backing them up and are going to be out for a while longer. But while Nintendo is soon to achieve things Microsoft and Sony already have, i.e. an HD console, PlayStation and Xbox look likely to retain an edge over Nintendo in the end by continuing to be one console ahead. Also, I'm afraid that Nintendo won't be able to convince me to buy the Wii U as they did with previous consoles. Do you think Nintendo will be able to sell it to people by saying, buy Wii U because of insert reason?
Yeah, it's a certain amount of pessimism surrounding the Wii U at the minute, I sense, among some people, or at least anxiety. But the first question, some of it will depend on how long Sony and Microsoft take to have a new console successors to the PS3 and 360.
And how powerful they are, too.
And how powerful they'll be, yeah. I mean, that's the other question. Will there be a sort of generational leap for them in the order of what we've seen in the past? Is that what we're expecting?
Well, right, and let's be clear. The Wii U is more than likely, to a measurable degree, more powerful than either of the other two systems. I mean, based on what we've heard, it seems to be. So maybe it's like a half step.
Yeah, although, I mean, one thing that you have to consider again is that sort of we talked about this related to the issue of having multiple tablets at once. Yeah, a certain amount of that power is going to be used on having a sort of duplicative display, or there's, you're doing stuff with the controller,
sure,
all that. So how much that is going to show up aesthetically in a given game is still very much unclear, especially when you're going to be dealing a lot of third-party games are going to be ports. So you wouldn't expect it to look appreciably better. And then Nintendo stuff, they're not really experienced with HD development, and graphics aren't really their priority. So I'm not sure that we're going to see Wii U come out and blow, you know, existing stuff out of the water at all.
I think the prevailing rumors at the moment are that it is capable of marginally better graphics than the other two systems at the moment. But it's a dev kit. They just got it. They still have to learn the system. It's a similar architecture to the Wii, I believe, but it's different, obviously.
That's the thing. The big question is with the next round of consoles is graphics are obviously, they're kind of, you know, starting to peak in terms of, you know, how much better they can get. I mean, certainly they can, you know, like Epic has, they're touting their new Unreal Engine coming
well,
out.
Well, Epic is the ultimate graphic horse, too. I mean,
well, exactly. I mean, that's their thing, right? But, you know, it's...
Because it's certainly not gameplay. Boom!
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, I think you'll kind of see other consoles kind of go in different directions in terms of what brings people to those consoles, right?
I think. Well, as you say, in terms of whether they've peaked, I mean, they can always get better, of course. They'll continue to get better, but it's that marginal effect what that actually gets you. It's like, well, yeah, it looks better, but in terms of how much more attractive does that make the product to the consumer? We're getting into that area of diminishing returns that Nintendo talked about with the Wii. And, you know, some people would argue very much about how true that was then in terms of, well, actually, you know, things do look a lot better in HD or this, that, and the other. But I think you're at this point, sort of post-HD, post-PS3, all that kind of stuff. I mean, even just from what you hear from developers, you know, do they want to kind of complete root up the goalposts and put them at this sort of generational leap down the line, you know, and all the kind of costs all that are associated with that? You don't really sense there's some great groundswell for that. I mean, the main reason why Nintendo's got a new console is because it wants to sell more consoles, really. Mm-hmm, right. And of course, in order to do that, you have to offer upgrades, and HD is an easy upgrade to offer. But if we're talking about, you know, as we've heard before, you know, a 360 successor, a PS3 successor, maybe, you're coming out in 2013, is it going to be meaningfully more powerful than the Wii U in such a way that the previous generation was?
Well,
the case?
I mean, let's keep in mind, though, that as these systems become more powerful, they become more expensive to develop for as well. So that certainly there'll be some reticence on some developers, not necessarily all of them.
Okay, but the argument usually against that is that middleware is always going to help out.
But you still have to produce more art assets. I mean, you just do. It, regardless of how good the middleware is, you still have to have an artist make art assets, make textures. It may be only marginally more difficult to build the character models, but you still have to decorate them. Right. And really, I would say that in the next console generation, it's probably going to be more the amount of textures you can put on the screen than it is the amount of polygons. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that hard to draw a bunch of polygons. Make them look nice is considerably more difficult. That's why it was always really funny when they would have new consoles and they'd say, it can push out 80,000 polygons. It's like, great. What do they look like? Oh, it's fucking triangles. Go away.
And that kind of era of nonsense is largely behind us. But I mean, I get the point I'm really getting at is, you know, will 360 successor or PS3 successor actually be quote unquote one console ahead?
I don't think anymore. I think in terms of, you know, the next Xbox, I think you're going to see is going to have Kinect heavily integrated into it.
Yeah, well, that's a no-brainer for Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll probably, you know, be tying into like Windows 8, Windows Phone, all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, it's going to be Microsoft's convergence box. I mean, based on how they've been driving the Xbox 360's enhancements recently, I would guess it's going to be much more of a multimedia device.
Yes.
All right, now, given the fact then that you might see that even though we don't expect the Wii U to be that much beyond the consoles that currently exist, there's still going to be greater parity between the platforms once we get to the point where each of them have one out, presumably right. A couple of years from now. That kind of draws us to the second part. What is it about the Wii U, therefore, if it's kind of, you know, not necessarily that different from the ones that are currently on the market and not that different from the ones that are going to be on the market, just on that technical level? Why are people going to be sold on it if they're going to be sold on it? What is the insert reason that Danny's asking for?
The controller.
I mean, the controller, but really there's also the franchises that they have, which may not be as vital as a sales tool as they used to be, but there's still something. I mean,
they're always there. I mean, when Danny talks about, you know, to be able to convince me in the same way, I mean, the franchises, I'm sure, have always been a part of that.
Right, but if you're listening to this podcast right now, the franchises are probably enough for you. I mean, you may say, well, I mean, this tablet's not really convincing me, but next time a Zelda game comes out, or next time the next Ascendant Mario game comes out, you're going to buy the console. I mean, I'm sorry if our listeners think I'm talking down to them, but you will.
Well, the fact is, it's a huge part. I mean, that's always, you know, for instance, with 3DS, you can have questions of like, well, how important is the 3D effect really, or the battery life's not great, or worries about having
it has battery life,
worries about having the two analog sticks, or but basically, like, I was willing to look past some of those concerns or risk factors or whatever you want to call them at the time, because what you do have is that certainty of, like, you know, they've got all these games in the pipeline already. Speaking for me, that they make my favorite games, and if they're going to make a big chunk of those on that platform, I want it. fine.
Yeah.
But obviously that isn't a big enough part of the market. Otherwise, GameCube would have been more successful and they wouldn't have done what they did with the Wii. So right. We're still searching for that reason. I mean, what do you think about that?
But I was going to point out that they've already, like, there's a way that they can shoot themselves in the foot despite having their franchises, and that's by doing what they did with the GameCube. Like, what if the first Mario game that comes out turns out to be a Luigi's Mansion, and the first Zelda that comes out is a cel-shaded Link? I mean, like, they can go directions with their franchises that the fans really don't care for.
I think you're overselling the hatred of Wind Waker. That game is widely revered.
Yeah, well, it's more love for the people that actually gave it a chance. I mean, you could still say that it actually put people off who then, you know, didn't think, oh, well, I've got to get a GameCube because it's going to be this Zelda game.
I don't have any of them that actually were.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily buying into that either, but you can make that case that maybe it didn't gin up enthusiasm as much as it might have done. But it's still possible. You could do things with franchises that aren't necessarily going to excite people in certain ways.
Like excite bots?
In any event, I think it's fair to say that even if you do a solid job of leveraging those things, that it's still not enough to compete in the big leagues. Especially, you know, as they've been the market leader in this generation. Obviously, they haven't been selling the most recently, but, you know, over the life cycle, they're still number one worldwide pretty comfortably. So that position, they certainly don't want to, you know, just surrender it. So, I mean, I'm just wondering, Gilbert, as we haven't spoken about Wii U on this show as much as we have, certainly. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the hook that you see with it yet? Or do you see one yet? Are we still waiting till maybe E3 to really get the idea?
Well, I think as soon as you put Measure Up in people's hands, they're going to see the power of the Wii U.
You know, people make jokes, but that actually was a legitimately fun thing to play against Johnny.
Well, the whole thing is, that the problem as I see it is all this concern is all stemming from the fact that we really haven't seen any real games in action for this thing. So it's hard for people to actually visualize.
I mean, I don't think the device was ready to be shown last year. It just wasn't.
We really don't have the concept of what Nintendo is going to do with this.
They're going to make a fucking great WarioWare game or Rhythm Heaven game. That's what they're going to do.
Well, like the demo that actually impressed me the most was Shield Up. And yeah. I think that the whole holding a second window into the game's world is going to be perhaps bigger than we think. Or at least, like, it was a pretty big thing to me when I played it.
Well, I mean, we'll see, because Bravely Default Frying Fairies has a little bit of that in there. That wasn't a racist joke, I just thought the idea of frying fairies was better. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think with Wii U, I do like the idea a bit better, because it's a bigger viewfinder, for a start. I mean, if we're talking about trying to sort of immerse yourself in the world kind of more in a way, you know, having a bigger screen like that to actually do it, I think matters. I think the 3DS screen is little, you're worried about the sweet spot, it's kind of limited, even though, as James said, I mean, they're trying to do some of that stuff with certain games. I think, you know, that kind of additional sort of interaction, that additional look into the game world, kind of making the game world more than just what's on the TV screen, it's a cool idea. But I think there's a couple of things. First of all, how do you really leverage it in a way that's robust in terms of gameplay? But secondly, how do you sell that? You know, looking at people holding up their tablets going, it's just dopey. It does
well,
not.
Yes. Weren't the Wii commercials dopey? I mean, they were pretty terrible.
Well, they were pretty dopey as well. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's always a bit of that, but I think it's just... The core thing about those is really you and your friends or family or whatever together having fun with this very physical kind of game.
I think the asymmetric gameplay we talked about, where they basically show one person playing on the screen and the people playing on the TV and just showing how they've seen different things and how they're interacting with each other. I think it's pretty easy to choreograph a commercial for this. It's just a matter of, do you have the game to show it off?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately the blank insert, blank reason, you know, that could well be at least a game, you know, the killer app or whatever that's a part of the launch lineup. I mean, that's the thing about Wii Sports, why that was so good, is it was something in itself, you know, that people wanted to play, clearly, but at the same time it sort of implied something about the whole platform and all the games that would come hence, that it was, you know, something that was more inviting, more accommodating than other games consoles for certain kinds of players. And obviously that, you know, local multiplayer was a big part of the platform, which again was unlike other consoles. I'm not sure, even if you have a game that's an excellent game and it makes very clever use of the tablet control and all that, that it could have the same sort of implications in people's minds and draw the same inferences about, okay, well, this is what the whole platform is, and therefore I can feel confident plonking down however much money it's going to take to buy this thing. I don't think any of us would think it would retail for more than 300, right?
Yeah, I doubt it.
I could see maybe 350, but 300 is kind of where I'm guessing.
I mean, because my feeling on it is, you, by the time we get to the end of this year, you've got to think 360 and PS3 are going to go down again in price, you know, and so, you know, the Wii U is going to be out there. I think if it's over 300, it's going to look expensive. So I don't think it's going to be over 300. But then again, with the currency issues, the manufacturing stuff, the controller and all that, I don't really see it being much under it either. So the only way that you can get it to fly off the shelves is with this kind of hook that Danny's kind of implying. And that, so far, it's not been demonstrated. I mean, this is where they've got to hit it big at E3. They've got to have something or a group of things so that we're all there thinking, oh, the marketing for this kind of writes itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll have a really good E3. I think that they'll have probably more games there than people think they will, and I think they're going to announce a lot of huge games in their own franchises, and people are pretty much going to lose their minds. Because I feel like going into it, people are kind of like, nah, whatever, we'll see what Nintendo does, but I have a feeling that coming out of it, I feel like people expect less out of the Wii U than Nintendo is actually going to give us.
Well, of course, we're all going to be very intrigued to see how Nintendo can allay concerns about the Wii U at E3, but we'll move on to the next letter now. Guillaume, you've got this one.
Robert in Georgia writes, in their latest issue, Game Informer magazine polled prominent game developers, asking them what they wanted out of a new console generation. The replies of performance, power, and pixels were typical. However, God of War creator David Jaffe stated that he wants more out of the handheld market. He relayed that as he gets older, he finds that he just doesn't have the time or the will to sit in front of a television for hours on end. I couldn't believe he said it, but I totally agreed with him. As a new father and someone in his mid-30s, this is comforting. I've been a gamer since the Atari 2600, and for the first time ever, I look forward to playing games on my portable rather than my console. I know your ages vary, but...
Sean.
As you get older and work longer hours, do you find that you prefer to pick up your portables as well? If you could have had it your way, would you have preferred games like Skyward Sword or Xenoblade on the go if it was possible? I've always loved Nintendo's handhelds, but now I am beginning to actually appreciate handhelds for their versatility, not just their games.
I would have never wanted to play Xenoblade on a handheld, ever.
Mm.
That game is just too beautiful to be on a handheld.
There's something to be said about the experience on a TV versus handheld.
For me, it's a trade-off thing there, because on the one hand, it's like, well, I probably could have played this a lot more. I probably could have completed it a lot quicker than the months that it took me to do it. As I've mentioned on the show, I probably could have delved into more of the side questy stuff and played it in a different way. But yeah, the spectacle wouldn't have been the same on a portable, even if, you know, you were talking about something that pretty much the same graphics, you wouldn't have, you know, had it blown up on the big screen.
And that music that just...
Yeah, you probably would end up playing it with the music not on a lot of the time.
Or at least not filling the room like it does in that. I mean,
yeah, it gave surround sound type of deal. I mean, headphones, you know, because, you know, 3DS games could sound good on headphones, but still not the same thing. So I could understand, you know, people, even if they do use their portables a lot, still might want kind of horses for courses. You want the games that are appropriate for the platform.
What about Vita games, though? We've got a taste of what it's like to get a console experience on the go with Uncharted, and reviewers seem to like it.
Yeah, I haven't got to see a Vita or anything, because obviously that's got a really gorgeous screen in itself. I mean, it's almost like...
I've played around with one. Actually, a guy at work has one, and he let me play it. I looked at Ninja Gaiden on it, and it looks close to a PS3 game, but I got the same vibe from the PSP, where I'm just like, wow, that looks really close to a PS2 game.
So, I mean, just in terms of the lifestyle issue, first of all, I mean, Guillaume, obviously, because you haven't spoken about these things much we have on the show, how do you consume games in that way? Have you gone more and more to portables as the years have progressed?
Well, no, my life situation's not really... I really play my handhelds at home, and I live by myself, so it's not... I can see the utility when you've got a family and they want the TV, so you can just play on your handheld and not bother anyone. Or, you know, like the girlfriend wants to watch TV, Grey's Anatomy, and you don't have to pay attention. So that's...
Oh no, that does not haunt.
it's not really a matter of, lifestyle. It's more, I play handheld games because they usually offer a different type of gaming experience. And I was a little bit afraid that as power went up, the experience would get closer and closer to console games, actually. For a while, like, the GBA was the only place that you could find 2D platformers. And I was really dreading the fact that, oh no, like, DS can do 3D games, and it's being launched with a remake of Super Mario 64. What am I going to do? But, you know, it turned out that, handheld budgets put a ceiling on the ambitions of the developers.
And there was still that kind of niche there, you know, that market that people wanted to play those sorts of games in general, and certainly wanted to play them portably if they were fans of the GBA and stuff. So it certainly made sense, you know, for that to be serviced. And even now, you know, with the 3DS, you still see plenty of side-scrolling types.
Yeah, and like we've heard that the next Mario game is going to be a side-scroller on the 3DS, and I couldn't be happier about it.
Oh, well, if it's new Super Mario Bros. 3D, I will not be happy. That is... First off, I won't approve of the punmanship, but that's just... That's unacceptably levels.
Draw the line, James. Draw the line.
Another thing we have to wait until E3 to kind of really size that one up, or what we've heard so far, is just like, investors, don't slit your wrists. We're going to keep milking Mario. It's okay.
Yeah.
In other news.
Yeah. For me, I use portables both ways. You know, like I will use it on the go. So it's not the 3DS that much yet, but as I said, we're doing the feature more so as time's gone on. But I do also use it in that multitasking kind of way. But principally, it really is because, you know, I want the games that are going to be on portable systems. You know, there's a lot of really great exclusive software. So moving on to kind of like the idea now, like certain kinds of games, you've heard some people, I don't know whether this was really the case with something like DQ9, but you certainly have had examples where major series have got the next like proper installment on a portable, and some people hate that idea. And I'm like, right. Oh God, I wish, you know, it was on a console instead. Like, have you ever been in that position?
Yes. I feel like I've seen games on handhelds where I said, man, I wish this was on a console. And it was when they decided to make all those Beautiful Joe handheld games. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, why are you doing this? This is a console series. And then I realized, yeah, this was a terrible idea, just like I thought it was.
Yeah, so I'd just say it does exist that people kind of the reverse of what Robert's saying, that they kind of wished that it was on a console. Some people, you're very particular, maybe, you know, if you've got like the great home entertainment set up and the TV, and you know, that you would prefer it that way. For me, I've not typically wanted one in or the other, kind of take it as they come.
Right, and that's generally my feeling on the matter. There is one game that I would have liked to have seen done on the console, and that was Radiant Historia. This may seem kind of weird, since it's actually a relatively scaled-down game graphics-wise. Just something about that game, I feel like if it was given... I mean, we haven't had a great JRPG this console cycle until maybe Xenoblade. I mean, it's been a rough console generation for those, and... That game had everything it needed except the graphics to be that hallmark game for this generation. And I remember thinking, man, if this were that game, that would be awesome. But it isn't.
So if it had the full treatment.
Well, and it had a really cool world, but a lot of it was left up to the imagination because it is a 16-bit game, effectively.
Yeah, and it was very much an homage to those games.
Right.
I guess that was a big part of its selling point. But John, I'm interested for you because obviously you do struggle sometimes to find the time to play things.
What?
Sometimes.
But then a lot of the stuff you talk about isn't necessarily on portables. So,
well, I generally stick to consoles, but I think, I mean, if I did have, you know, a daily train commute, I would be playing the heck out of my 3DS. I just would, because it's just...
But John's an American now. He doesn't agree with public transportation.
I wish I could take the train to work. Unfortunately, I can't. Hopefully, I can move somewhere near a train line. But with the DS, a lot of the games have been, you know, experiences where you have to put a lot of time into them. And typically, I kind of look to handhelds for that. Something like Super Mario 3D Land, where you can, you know, make a little bit of progress and then walk away from it. Really not a lot of story. You don't have to forget, you know, there's nothing you can really forget. Like, if you put it down for a few days and don't come back to it, you don't really miss anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, like, with Historia, I completely forget, really, a lot of the plot of that game right now if I went back to it. So, sorry, James.
Jesus!
But yeah, but that's kind of the sad thing for me, is that a lot of games like that, I'm in this kind of middle ground where, you know, I don't necessarily have the time to sit there and play all the way through with, I mean, all of these games. I mean, not just on Nintendo platforms, but stuff like Mass Effect. Like, all of these games, I love the idea of playing through them, but actually sitting down for 60 hours playing through them, probably not going to happen. Just because, you know, with the time that I have, it's much easier for me to, you know, play like some, like a first-person shooter online for like an hour or two and then just drop off, and I don't have to like worry about coming back to it. There's nothing to pick up.
Oh, the downloadable shooters you've spoken about, they're very easy to just sort of slip into. I mean, that's why a lot of the stuff I play, virtual console games, works the same way.
But yeah, you know, but I still find myself, though, the one good thing about handhelds, though, is that, you know, if there is stuff going on around you, like, say, you know, like I can be sitting here in one room playing it and, you know, my wife needs something in the other room and I can just put it down, go over, you know, help her do whatever she wants to do, come back to it and pick it right up. So that's kind of what I like. Whereas, you know, with a console game, it's sort of like, you know, you're usually, they don't cater to just stopping. Usually, you know, you either have to like go to a save point or do something like that. I mean, there a lot of times the play experience is tailored to sort of being hunkered down and being focused on the game for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's the big thing, is that in that sense, the utility of portables for people as they get older is very much, not so much as they get older themselves, but you know, their living circumstances change. If they do have kids in particular, like Robert does,
yep,
and all that, you know, those sorts of obligations, it's very difficult to just close yourself off and get immersed in a console game.
That's exactly it. And that's why people do love iPhone games. I have a friend at work who, you know, he has a really, really small kid. I always make fun of him because he plays Angry Birds. But he said, yeah, the reason why I play Angry Birds is because literally I play it before I go to bed at night, because that's the only time I have to myself literally the entire day. So just sitting down and playing at a console, not even a part of his life. He would love to, has no time to do it.
So John, how many kids do you have then?
None. That's why I still play games.
The day we get the ultrasound, he's off the show, basically. But I guess the greater kind of recognition of portable games in general, I mean, obviously we talk about iPhone stuff and that, but I think also it does offer more of a route now. There's a greater parity between portable and console, especially in Japan. Obviously, we always go on about that, and that has a big ripple effect if we're talking about the Nintendo scene. That maybe as people are getting into their 30s or whatever, and they're becoming family people now, they might actually be more likely to keep gaming than they were in the past. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, they might have just driven them out altogether. Now maybe the 3DS or iOS or Vita or whatever actually stands a better chance of keeping them interested in games in general. And that's one way in which the market can continue to be bigger. It's just through, not just by bringing in new people, but better retention.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll move on to the next question now. And John, you've got that one.
All right. Ahmed writes, I'd like your opinions on the 3DS stand that's being packed in with Kid Icarus Uprising, because I just don't see the point of it. Surely all this piece of plastic does is effectively limit your 3DS to indoor gaming. In my eyes, Nintendo had two options with this particular franchise. Either design the game to be more playable on the go, or work on it as a home console title, perhaps even a Wii U launch title. On the same note, I am also interested to know how you would go about reviewing games that are just about playable without a particular peripheral, but are far more enjoyable with it, e.g. Metal Gear Solid 3D and Resident Evil Revelations, with Circle Pad Pro.
You're always a little bit suspicious of that when that's written there.
Would you judge gameplay on the standards of the system alone or with the peripheral in use? Obviously, if the games come with all that stuff included, that's okay, but in the examples above, the Circle Pad Pro had to be bought separately, which indicates to me that the developers were confident that their games would function adequately without the peripheral and therefore should perhaps be reviewed as such.
So I think I'm a semi-active reviewer, so I have a little bit of experience with this. To me, I generally am of the mind that you review the game as you would play it. Now, in the review, I need to be honest and come and say, so I played it with this. If I can, I should try to experiment it without, but I should make it clear that your mileage may vary depending on your control options. I'm not going to deliberately not play the game the optimal way the majority of the time simply because that's the bare minimum barrier to entry. I mean, I may experience it and then make commentary on it, but for a game like Resident Evil Revelations, I own the game. I could be playing it right now, but I'm not because I'm waiting for a damn Circle Pad Pro. Because when I tried to play it without it, it wasn't enjoyable.
With on the subject of Revelations, for me, I did try out the regular control scheme a little bit. But if I were reviewing it, I'm sure I would have played it more that way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily all of it, just for like review purity, but I would have been more rigorous to say, okay, well, how well does this function relative to the Circle Pad Pro control scheme, all that kind of thing. So there is a difference there.
Right. Now here's the difference in scenario, which is you get Revelations to review. I know I'm picking on this game. Let's make it Metal Gear Solid, because that game's fucking broken. You get Metal Gear Solid, and you don't have a Circle Pad Pro. You don't own one. I think it's perfectly legitimate to review that game without it if you don't own one, simply because the vast majority of 3DS owners don't own it.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something, in a way, it's like, where do you draw the line? But clearly, on an intuitive level, that is a big factor in this, because if you say, for instance, we're talking about something like Xenoblade, and some people say, oh, the classic controller's the best way to go, most people wouldn't, like, think it's a big deal.
The game is still perfectly playable without it.
It's perfectly playable without it, but also, at this point in the system's life, like most people that would ever want to use a classic controller have one.
Well, and you can go to any store in the world and buy one.
Yeah.
It's not like the Circle Pad, where only GameStop has them and they're all sold out everywhere.
So those sorts of considerations, even though, you know, it's not about the game per se, you know, even though with reviews, you normally we're looking at the game's merits and all that, but that kind of context of like, well, how likely are people going to be to have this particular thing?
I don't know that you have to provide that much full context. Like, let's talk about Kid Icarus. I'm not sure you need to provide that much context for this, because all it does in the relatively laziest implementation to date is they basically said, now you can use the left analog stick too. Or the right one.
With the Circle Pad Pro issue, yeah. Well,
right, it doesn't actually fix the control scheme.
No. It's just making it more approachable for left-handers. But
for the genetically deficient, yeah.
Lovely. You know, I mean, what's interesting about that, though, actually, is I thought, I imagined that would be the case originally, because it's like, okay, well, probably you can only aim with the stylus. So that's it. You know, the game's built around stylus aiming. Like I said, in many ways, it is a lot quicker switching targets with the stylus. So it might be a bit much to kind of give an option that while it might be more comfortable, you're not necessarily going to be as well equipped to actually deal with what the game's throwing at you. So they'll just keep it, you know, it's all stylus aiming, and then we'll have the Circle Pad for lefties, and that's it. That's not exactly the case, though, because there is a mode where you could use the face buttons to do some aiming.
Yes.
So
it's why it's so dumb.
In which case, well, if you're going to allow that, well, why not then do dual analog with the Circle Pad Pro? That's where it gets weird. I mean, I'm not sure. I still might prefer, in that circumstance, to actually use the stylus aiming, because again, I think the game is built around that. But if you're going to allow people, you know, that sounds really awful. I don't know why you'd ever want to use the face buttons in that way. You're very much getting into Metal Gear Solid territory at that point. But still, if you're going to do that, you may as well just extend it out to dual analog. I think that's very curious indeed at that point. Now, in terms of the stand, let's address that. Was the first part of Ahmed's letter. So, I mean, I think it's very odd decision, because
that's an understatement.
Two things. It's reducing your margin on it because they're not selling it for a higher price.
Well, yeah, but that stand is just a piece of plastic. I mean, it's not
But it all adds up. When you assess that over all the millions that they're hoping to sell of this thing.
They aren't selling millions of copies of this game.
You still look at the production values and everything that goes into this game. It's the sort of thing that they would hope to sell millions of it worldwide. And all those, you know, few cents or pence or yen or whatever in all the different territories that you added to the unit cost that you took out of your margin adds up. That's significant in itself. Second thing, though, is that for people, you know, that might not be immersed in these sorts of things the way we are, or probably a lot of our listeners are, it implies that it's needed, which is bad. Because it's very much not needed. It's not really that helpful. It certainly could result in people thinking, well, God, I'm only going to be able to play this when I'm next to a desk. You know, because you've got to be elevated to some extent as well. You know, if you're going to sort of play it that way, whatever surface you're going to kind of set it down on. So at that point, you're just wondering whether it's just going to put people off even buying it. If they say, well, what kind of bloody game needs this thing to even do it? You know, when it really doesn't. I mean, did Metroid Prime Hunters come with a stand? No.
Well, it should have.
This no more requires it than that did.
Well, at least, because, you know, when I think of bad controls, I always think of, you know, like Monster Hunter on PSP.
Oh, alligator gripping.
Yeah, yeah, you had to do the whole claw thing to actually, you know, control it. But, you know, at least with that game, you didn't find that out until after you bought it. So they already screwed you over.
They're not telegraphing.
This one's just advertising it right out there. Look, here's a stand.
Just an FYI, these aren't good controls.
It does send a bad message, I think.
It does.
The fact that they conceded in their own mind, like, yeah, we kind of need to do this. It just, you know, I question whether they did need to do it, but the fact that they felt they did just it sends a bad message. That's something that you've seen in the review coverage of the game. It's just like, if somebody doesn't like the controls, it's a very easy substantiation for them to make. It's like, well, you know, here it is. This proves my point.
You know, we talked about that the stand's not mandatory, but it is mandatory for the sake of comedy.
I think it's a really bizarre situation that probably, I can only assume maybe it was a result of some sort of, you know, like focus testing kind of thing.
This needs a piece of plastic.
They ran it by people and they were like struggling with it, and then they thought, this is going to be too unapproachable, so we're just going to pack this thing. You're trying to sort of fix something late in the day, which is a band-aid at best kind of scenario, and it adds nothing. Okay, well, let's move on to the next letter now. I've got this one. It's Chris in Chicago, and he writes, "The recent announcement that the 3DS Fire Emblem game will have downloadable content led me to think about what might be the best suited Nintendo franchises for downloadable expansions. The Punch-Out series immediately struck me as the perfect opportunity for Nintendo to milk me for every dollar I'm worth. I would be more than willing to pay $5 to $10 every few months in order to add a few original opponents to the game. With each new console, Nintendo would simply have to make a Punch-Out game designed for that hardware and then trickle out the DLC over the life of that console. It's the perfect opportunity. What other Nintendo-published franchises do you think would benefit the most from DLC?" Guillaume, would you like to kick us off with this one?
I'm a terrible person for this topic. I've never bought any kind of expansion or downloadable content for the PS3 or anything. So I don't know. Like I usually feel like when I'm done with a game, I'm done with a game, and I've had my fill and I want to move on. But I guess, like, Nintendo has done DLC in the past, except it's done it without the internet. And that was with, for instance, the Super Mario Advance version of Super Mario 3.
E-reader.
Remember, you had these cards. Yeah, the e-reader cards. I never had the e-reader, so I never played those extra levels. But they sounded cool. So, like, why not have downloadable levels for perhaps classic Mario games? Like, Nintendo seems to want to sell us the same ROMs over and over again. Perhaps they're going to be, like, remaking their old Super Mario games and to allow for the possibility for expansion.
Well, it's something that they've already kind of suggested a little bit. They've talked about having DLC, you know, expanding their ability to provide it at investors' conference, and something. The example that they've given is more Mario levels. So, and I mean, clearly you would think that from the e-reader example, in a way. I mean, something with like those sorts of discrete levels is very much the sort of game that you would expect. You know, it's not as easy if you've got something that's about an interconnected game world like Metroid or Zelda. It's, you know, you could do it. There's plenty of games that do that on the other consoles, but I'm not sure it's the first candidate that would spring to mind or that it would benefit the most from it. I mean, first of all, you've got music games. I think that's very easy. You've already seen that plenty on Nintendo consoles with Rock Band and all that kind of stuff. And they're doing it with Theatre Rhythm in Japan already.
Right. Which is now coming to the West, by the way.
Yeah, this summer, Europe and America. But, I mean, in terms of Nintendo stuff, I would love downloadable Rhythm Heaven games. That would be great.
Yeah, it works well. Or WarioWare, really.
Yeah, I mean, you could do... Yeah, again, they're very discreet, just like different packs of levels that are associated with a character. Like, if you could just do another one of those or something, I mean, that seems totally kind of doable. And, of course, they've ventured into that digital space a bit with WarioWare, with the DIY and being able to play it, like, through WiiWare and stuff like that.
Yeah, except that you can't really check whatever game that you want to download. You have to know the person. You have to trade codes.
There's plenty of infrastructural things that they have to do better. And it sounds like with the eShop and, you know, with Theatre Rhythm, it's actually with Theatre Rhythm, you know, from the impressions that we've had from our Japan team, that, you know, it's all built into the game, isn't it? So it's really easy to buy this stuff. And so all that seems like they've got it in a row, and it's just a case of how much Nintendo wants to take advantage of it. And so music games, those sorts of mini games, things. Also, if it's good for Fire Emblem, it's good for Advance Wars, as far as I'm concerned.
I would say Advance Wars is probably easier for, because
it's not in a story the way that Fire Emblem is.
Right, and you have those independent battles that you can play in Advance Wars.
The side missions, that Guillaume's reference. So, I mean, Advance Wars definitely makes loads of sense.
Now here's the no-duh one, which is Smash Brothers.
Yeah, fighting games, you know, characters, levels, it's always the kind of thing you could do. So,
and I mean, they could literally add a character a month to Smash Brothers for like 3 years.
Well, I don't know, because it would have to be on the disc first.
Oh! This isn't Namco, come on.
Heyo!
Oh, you want Yoda? Actually, Yoda is on your disc. We've been keeping him from you. But that'll be $10. Fuck you!
But we mentioned Advance Wars. Is there a fear that, you know, Advance Wars has always included the maps from the past games? So is there a fear that Nintendo is going to start charging for content that we used to get free?
Well, I think it's legitimate. I mean, I think they may try, and, you know, they know, especially with some of these franchises that might be, you know, a bit more dominated by people that are longtime fans. I mean, they'll be sensitive, I think, to the concerns of people. Like, you know, it's the easiest way to piss people off. It's like, here's something that you used to get, you know, included for free, if you were looking at it that way, and now we're taking it away from you and you have to pay for it. It's a notion of fairness. You know, I used to get this. I'm entitled to it. I deserve it, whatever. You can't take that away. So if it's a game, I think Advance Wars might be a bit too, you know, people that play Advance Wars probably play a lot of other Advance Wars. You'd have to be careful about how you handle it so it didn't seem like a total ripoff.
Or you could just be like Activision and not give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, there's that way too. But obviously, with a lot of those games that Activision do that with, they appeal to big, big, big sectors of people. You know, it's not just like a relatively contained fan base, so they can feel they could do that. So, yeah, I mean, it's not that easy. I think they're going to have to try and do it so it feels more truly additional, rather than just we're dividing this up differently and making a different payment plan.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, they might even, like, you know, put like a certain amount of time between the time when they release the game and then put out the DLC. Whether or not they had that DLC already sitting in the can, you know, but kind of making it feel like, okay, well, this game was as good as and had as much content as any other game in the series that's been released previously, and now this DLC is actually just more content that was released later, so obviously they put extra time into...
I mean, wasn't it the big thing? Assassin's Creed 2 got a lot of shit because it just does this big skip in time towards the end of the game, and then they filled in that skip with DLC, and it's kind of like, okay, so basically you didn't finish the game on time, and then you're going to sell those bits that you didn't finish as DLC. You want to avoid that.
that's not good. Yeah. I really think if you want to avoid any negative blowback, DLC really needs to be self-contained and very clearly designed to be self. If it looks like you're just filling in the holes, it's going to go badly for you.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot. Like right now, there is a RPG action less RPG now trilogy where this is a relevant point of discussion.
Yeah, I think that will probably feature on a future episode, that discussion. But yeah, I mean, Punch-Out, I think, is kind of a decent example, actually. Because, I mean, I love Punch-Out, first of all, but the thing is with that is, like, say, for instance, if you want to do, like, a sequel to Punch-Out, is like, all it would be is, like, more boxes. Or you do, like, stupid things to try to spruce it up, like, oh, he's got a new kind of super punch, and it'd be like Mario Power Tennis, you know, where it's, you take away from the purity of it just to kind of justify the fact that it's a sequel, and that you'd be better off just giving more of what was in that base game. You know, I think there's certain games like that that are kind of very sort of simple, you know, again, like kind of like Rhythm Heaven as well. I mean, Rhythm Heaven structurally is completely identical, well, almost completely identical on the three different platforms it's on. Yep. So you could pretty much never do a sequel to Rhythm Heaven on the same platform. It would feel like a ripoff, but you could do DLC. That's the thing.
Yeah, no question.
So that's where I think those are the best kinds of examples. Punch-Out definitely works in that way. One that's a bit different, I did think about it just in terms of self-contained, Pikmin does have separate areas. You know, they're not interconnected, so you could just have a new, you know, now the dolphin or whatever can go to a new place, and you know, would probably do a better job of extending the life of the game than just putting a bunch of randomly generated areas like they did in the second one. So, I mean, that's a bit more kind of adventurous in terms of DLC than just adding fighters in a fighting game or something. But it's a possibility if they do actually, you know, revive Pikmin first.
A missed opportunity, I think, is DLC for Star Fox. I mean, like, they had a problem, I guess, with the budget. Like, they wanted to keep the cost, so they remade Star Fox 64 instead of making a new one. And they're like, well, if this sells well enough, we're going to give you a new game. But if they had the hooks to make DLC for it, then perhaps, you know, like, they could try to sell a new campaign for it.
I think though, that one they probably want to sell as its own game.
Well, and also they just was looking to pad the release lineup at that point. But yeah, if you was looking at Star Fox Project at a different point in the console's life cycle, you know, and then you would say, yeah, it's a remake, but this is kind of, again, it would feel additional, wouldn't it? Legitimately additional. It's like, well, that's the game that was already released. And then, you know, there's this extra stuff on top of it, maybe. But any other examples that anyone's got there? Franchises that they'd either like to see or think we will see, perhaps? I mean, Animal Crossing always gets brought up. Do you think that's going to happen? The sort of horrible microtransactions kind of?
I mean, I could see, I mean, extra racetracks for Mario Kart or
F-Zero.
F-Zero, if it ever comes out.
F-Zero chance of seeing a sequel.
That's brilliant. You'll be here all night, folks.
With Mario Kart, you find yourself in a situation, though, where like everyone would have to buy the DLC to keep playing together online. Is that an obstacle, or actually, is that good for Nintendo?
Well, it depends. That's why I kind of said, you know, you have to make the original game meaty enough.
Well, I mean, with Mario Kart, there's a very clear sort of... because it's so consistent, you know, at this point, where it's like, okay, you get 32 tracks, you get 16 new ones, you get 16 old ones, and that's it. You know, like, if you did that and then said, okay, and now we'll release another four old ones that have been jazzed up, like, it would feel additional, wouldn't it? You know, because it's like, well, yeah, you know, we already got our usual, again, like, going back to, you know, the sort of established notions of fairness when it comes to Mario Kart, so we already got our fair share. This is more if you want it. Yes, they would have to take a more kind of open approach to how they handle online, but I mean, that wouldn't be a bad thing, because they'd leave it open, like, you know, correcting that horrible woohoo glitch that's yeah, just made it, you know, really unbearable to play online sometimes if you end up with the wrong group of people in a random situation. So I certainly wouldn't be opposed to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the way they handle that with FPS games is, you know, you'll have with that, I mean, there's constantly DLC coming out, so you have players at all different DLC, you know, right, content. Usually what happens is you just can't see that DLC.
Well,
so
you can't
even choose from it.
Or you end up with games where you can buy weapons and somebody has ridiculous ultra-powered weapon.
Yeah, it's not DLC per se. It's just a problem with their design and balancing.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean that's kind of the challenge you have to run into with a shooter DLC if you're going to let them get weapons.
Yeah,
I mean it's not just a matter of like we're talking about balancing, but you have to produce content that A, users want, and B, users don't think they're being ripped off by.
It's a tightrope balancing kind of deal, isn't it? And obviously Nintendo just sort of, you know, coming to it kind of later than a lot of people. I think they are going to be more cautious with it than some people would be in the past. They've certainly had an idea of like, we want it all clean and simple. You know, when you buy a box product from us, that's the whole experience. You're getting the whole thing. But at this point, I think it's got to the stage where, you know, when you look at what they're saying to their investors and stuff, you know, yes, we understand there's all these other companies that are making a shitload off this, so we can't ignore it, and we need to think about the best ways to exploit it, but they're still...
But not exploit it.
Yeah, they're really severely exploitative. They want to avoid that kind of impression.
Right. See, and that's sort of a disadvantage for them as a company, because a lot of the companies don't give a shit if they're viewed as exploitive about it. I mean, Activision doesn't care if you think they're exploiting you, because they are.
No, exactly. But that's the thing. At the same time, like Activision, what do they have to lose in that regard?
Right.
Like, people have this kind of affectionate, cuddly kind of attachment to Nintendo that breeds... or is part of brand loyalty and all that stuff that keeps them buying their products. You know, there is something of a risk there that you can fuck with that perception and actually, you know, estrange some people from you. So,
but the thing is, to be fair, Nintendo has fucked with that perception in a lot of other ways, and their fans still haven't abandoned them. So
they're going to do it, but I don't think they're just going to jump in with both feet. Let's go crazy.
Right. They're not going to horse armor you.
No. Mario's cap, $2. Put it on Mario. He doesn't come with his cap, but you can buy it for $2.
I'm still trying to remember what RPG it was where you could buy weapons in DLC and then give them to the character, and it was only a temporary character. Once they left, you lost the weapon.
I think it was Dragon Age. I think it was Dragon Age, but I'm not sure about that.
Oh, that's right, it was Dragon. They just walked off with your shit. The game actually stole from you.
That's brilliant.
The game fucking stole from you.
it's going to happen. I don't know how I feel about it yet. I think a lot of it's going to be about managing perceptions as well as the reality of it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if there's anybody that would take a kind of a measured approach to it, a considerate approach, I think it probably will be Nintendo, at least at first. Maybe then if they find that, you know, it's actually a rich vein of cash, the dollar signs might start appearing in their eyes and the lust for it just overwhelms them. But we're probably a little way off from that yet. Anyway, let's move on to our final letter. And this one is from Jay. So James, why don't you read it?
Jay writes, I just wanted to say that I really liked your discussion about gameplay. One part that really stood out to me was Greg's explanation about how Nintendo games tend to be very immediate and intuitive with their controls and the way the characters react to them. This stood out because it put into words, in an autonomous way, all the problems I had with the controls in Skyward Sword. I went into the game expecting to treat the remote like a sword, making wide sweeping motions to swing it in the game. However, the quirk of the sword is that it registers as a swing when you move the remote quickly enough, so I often found myself making Link slash when I was actually just winding up for my swing. Unfortunately, this caused a major disconnect between me and the game because I was constantly aware that I had to go against my intuition to avoid swinging in the wrong direction during the windup. The point about intuitive controls in the gameplay discussion made me realize that Skyward Sword was the first time that a Zelda game didn't feel like a Nintendo game to me. Maybe I'm just the odd man out here since the game's gotten so many positive reviews, but I felt like the motion controls, which are supposed to make the game more immersing and engaging, had the complete opposite effect on me. Have you guys ever played a game where the controls weren't necessarily bad, but they didn't work the way you felt they should, and you felt the game suffered because of it?
Well, I suppose just to tackle some of the Zelda issues first, does anybody else feel similarly?
I wanted it to be quick, because I didn't want to have to do wide arcing swings. I mean,
I suppose that is an issue. I mean, what you have here is kind of the dichotomy between Skyward Sword and Red Steel 2. In the case of Red Steel 2, you know, a number of reviews mentioned the fact that, I got really tired out playing this game because you actually have to swing quite hard to get it to work, although that was modifiable.
Also, you're playing Red Steel 2.
That'll tire her out right there.
The point being that in that case, I'm guessing that's what they were concerned about, that if it wasn't, if it was too easy, that people would actually end up, you know, registering a swing when they didn't intend to. In that case, at least, you know, you aren't going to swing by accident in Red Steel 2.
Right.
So on the one hand, some people saw a negative in that. I'm guessing, I'm not sure whether Jay has played Red Steel 2. I doubt he has, but perhaps he, in that sense, would have found that to be preferable because it more sort of comported with his expectations, which seems to be the issue here. But Guillaume, what were your thoughts on the Skyward Sword controls? I they agree with you.
I didn't play Skyward Sword for very long.
Oh, no!
I'm sorry. Well, I did get, you know, a couple of dungeons in, and I don't know, like, I didn't feel like it was that much of a problem. So
the controls weren't the issue in terms of you not playing for longer?
Yeah, no, Fee and the length of the tutorial at the beginning and the wordiness in general, just they're the things that put me off the game. But yeah, like, at least the sword was precise enough. Like, you had to slash at different angles, and you could do that, unlike Dragon Quest swords, which didn't work. Like, you could not do a simple 45-degree angle swing. Like, you just couldn't. And you needed to for a lot of that game.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I agree with that much. It's up to a level of nuance where, you know, those sorts of gameplay concepts work. Although I got on pretty well with the controls, but I will say that some of these little idiosyncrasies about, you know, the recognition and all that, they were still there in my mind. And so I would say that it wasn't the most immersive thing. It was still a sense of making sure that it was going to work right. Whereas, you know, if you think of a lot of games where they have great controls, they are such that you forget about them. The controller just kind of melts into your hands and your brain, and you just do stuff. Mm. I wouldn't say that Skyward Sword ever got to that point. And in some ways, it doesn't try to. It's trying to be showy, you know, with all these enemies that require you to slash in different directions and all the different ways you use it. I mean, it's being very demonstrative about, you know, how it's using Wii Motion Plus. So that's not really its intent. But still, it's just I was kind of aware of them. And sometimes that was kind of, you know, dragging me a bit out of the experience a little bit. So even though I think I've quite a different experience from Jay, I could see where he's kind of coming from in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of went into it. I didn't expect it to be really, really immersive, but pretty much got what I expected, which was this is going to be a cool way to swing your sword in a realistic manner. So that's the thing. It comes down to very much like what you expect of it.
No, and I mean, I think if you've played Wii Sports Resort, then, you know, you've got a certain amount of expectancy about how they're going to handle the sword in that. Yeah. Because, I mean, with Wii Sports Resort, the duel or whatever, I mean, you could just sort of vibrate the controller and that counts as a swing.
Right.
So you kind of knew that you weren't going to have to be doing big motions. And so, you know, I think, yeah, they had to make a sort of compromise there in terms of, yeah, you might get some. I mean, it happened to me. There would be times where I was like, you know, I wanted to swing one way and I swung the other way because I was a bit too sort of excited about drawing it back or whatever. I mean, that did happen,
yeah,
as Jay describes, but not too often. And, you know, I think it's just a compromise because a lot of people would have been some people complained anyway of like, oh, well, I don't want to stand up and play this game. You know, Zelda's a game I might play for hours at a time, so I don't want to be worn out by it. You know, they had to kind of balance those concerns with what kind of motions were going to be required.
Isn't there a limit anyway to the extent that the sword swinging can be immersive when you're swinging, you know, just the hilt?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's no counterweight involved, obviously.
And it's the inherent kind of dopiness of it as well.
Well, I mean, if you bought the plastic sword kits that came out when the Wii was new.
Oh, yeah, that's not dopey. Then you're playing with power.
Shut up, James. Shut up.
Hey, that's being a pro gamer. I will alienate everyone by the end of this episode.
But, yeah, I think I take the point that it is quite different. Even though I would, you know, generally go along with the idea that the controls are good, they're a positive aspect of the game, and certainly a distinguishing aspect of it compared to other Zelda games.
Right.
I accept the premise that, you know, it's not what I was talking about in the gameplay discussion about what you think of, you know, if you think of the controls in Zero Mission or Super Mario Bros. 3 or stuff like that. Right. It isn't quite like that, because that connection, even though it's meant to be like, oh, 1-to-1 and, you know, you hold it at this angle and he holds it at that angle, yeah, with the calibration stuff and all this, it isn't as immediate as that. It isn't as direct and dependable. But you're kind of trading nuance off for that.
You know, I know that Nintendo wasn't the primary developer here, but Sakamoto worked on it. Other M got lots of derision for the controls being somewhat dopey.
Yeah, see, that's a good example, because I think that might be a game that some people would point to for the latter part of Jay's letter there. So, you know, if you played a game where the controls weren't necessarily bad, but they didn't work the way you felt they should. Because some people just think the controls in that game are bad. So right. That would be the first group. They wouldn't agree with that. But then I think there's other people, and I'm almost in this camp, apart from the fact that the D-pad on the Wii Remote leaves is something to be desired. If it was a better sized D-pad, if it was a better sized D-pad, I really wouldn't have a trouble
without the big sharp angles on the side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm more of a fan of those controls, because I think there's a lot of things actually that work really well with the controls in that game. For instance, a lot of the environments are designed in a very angular way. So the fact that you don't have the 360 control of an analog stick is not really a big deal. And the other thing is it's got a very sort of instant kind of quality to it by virtue of digital. The way you could kind of tap to dodge and all that kind of stuff, it's got this real twitchiness to it that I don't think it would have if it was an analog stick. But because it's in the situation of like a third person, three dimensional action game, at first you're just like, this doesn't compute. This is not
disorienting.
Well, yeah, it's not what you do. Then the whole switching to first person thing with the missiles is a whole other kettle of fish.
Oh no!
But again, I think your experience, at least early on, and for some people, clearly, probably for the entire game, does suffer just because of how foreign it is, how much out of your normal experience the controls are. And those sorts of things do matter. I mean, that's one thing, like with Resident Evil Revelations, with the Circle Pad Pro. Yeah, for me, it was just like, well, if I have the Circle Pad Pro, it's just going to control like Dead Space, and I know how to control that. But of course, what that does as well, the downside of that is it kind of boxes people in, design-wise, doesn't it? Of like, well, let's conform and have all these games kind of get homogenized. I like the idea, perhaps, you know, more so sometimes than the execution, but I like the idea of developers that are willing to go outside the box and say, well, this controls the way it is because it's the best way for this game.
Yeah, I miss that a lot in a lot of games. Like the whole standardization of dual analog controls, I'm really against it. And I miss the creativity of the PlayStation 1 days and N64 days. Like Jumping Jack Flash might not have been, you know, the most intuitive game, but it did.
Wow, you went to that one.
Well, why not?
I bet half the listeners are going, who the f*** is that?
Well, you know, it might have not been the optimal way. Like now, perhaps, like we would be like strafing with the shoulder buttons and stuff like that, but the game didn't require strafing. Like it wasn't built that way. And it was more unique for it. It was more interesting.
I mean, I think you look at the original Sin of Punishment is a pretty good example in terms also, of, again, yeah, that was not something that you were used to doing. Like, because I'm moving the character with the D-pad and I'm aiming with the analog stick. Or
Mischief Makers is a good example.
Yeah, I mean, Treasure have been quite particular with it.
Well, they still make weird controls. So that
but,
may
you know,
not...
the thing about Treasure, though, is that the game designs always reflect it. It's always, you know, built into it very purposefully. It's not just some arbitrary thing like, oh, we want you to use this for some agenda or some nonsense. It's like they felt that fit the design, and they built the one around the other.
Sometimes, I don't know, I feel like games have perhaps gotten a little bit too complicated for their own good. I'm really grateful for Nintendo to go with the Wiimote route, because I look at dual analog schemes when I'm, you know, sometimes they shoot the controls when you're playing a demo on PS3 or 360, and I don't understand what's going on. Like, there's too many controls, and you hear about... I still haven't played Arkham City, Batman Arkham City, but Like, you hear of people having to push, like, hold three shoulder buttons while simultaneously, you know, using both control sticks and pressing one of the face buttons. And I'm just wondering, how did this happen? Like, when did it get this way?
Yeah, it's a bit of a crutch as well, isn't it? Like, having all these different buttons, like, oh, let's just put another action on another input and all that. I mean, sometimes, yeah, there can be something said, well, you know, if you have the restrictions of having fewer buttons or sort of that, it can actually discipline the developers.
Yeah.
And kind of make something that does fit that limited controls, but it ends up streamlining things and making it easier to control, easier to understand. Whereas it's just sort of the easy way out of saying, well, we could always just put that on clicking the right analog stick.
Yeah. Well, there's always the sense, especially with games in series, that you have to add more. So
yeah, just layers on top of each other.
Right.
Yeah. Now you have 20 moves. I agree, though. I agree very much that, you know, sometimes I'll put a game down and go away from it for a while, and then I'll come back to it.
What?
I have a habit of doing that. But the thing is, what I find is certainly with some of these games, I'll come back and I'll be like, wow, I haven't played this game for a while, but how in the hell do I control it? And so I have to sit there for about a half an hour playing it, just kind of like dicking around, just trying to figure out how the controls work again.
And like, people were disappointed when the Wii came out, and like the Wiimote didn't live up to the promise of the revolution. You know, like, it wasn't one-to-one motion controls, and instead it was waggle, like Super Mario Galaxy. Oh, you have to shake the controller to spin. You could have done that with a regular controller. But, like, I think that's really missing the point. Like, you could have done that with a regular controller, except, like, the way the setup is now, like, you don't have, your thumb doesn't have to leave its spot ever. It greatly simplifies the controls. And while that might not be as important to people like us, I think it does make a huge difference to, you know, people who don't play games as regularly.
And it differentiates it more as well, doesn't it? You know, it's in terms of people remembering the issue that John talked about. If you're struggling to remember something, you know, it's much easier to forget if it's one of four face buttons, all right, which one of those does the thing I'm thinking of. Whereas you're probably not going to forget what the shake does because it's so different.
Yeah, in Super Mario Galaxy, like, it's well chosen because the spin takes a lot of time to execute, so you don't have to be as precise with it. And I gotta point out also that the fact that the camera is automatic is probably a much bigger deal for people than the fact that your thumb doesn't have to leave the button. Like, but of course, like, that takes a lot of work.
Yeah, so if you're going to take away a lot of it's kind of like the easy thing to do in some ways, just, oh, we'll turn the camera control over to the player. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they can't really complain about it.
Well, they can if it's hard to control and it gets stuck in the wall.
That's true, yeah. But you know what I mean.
Like, fuck you, Avatar for Wii.
If you're going to take kind of responsibility for it and automate a lot, it can make the player's experience a lot better. Right? One thing I love about the Galaxy games is you don't have to think about it. You just accept the view that you're given and navigate accordingly, and it's just more instant that way. So in that case, that's the thing. I think with Wii, I think you've had a number of circumstances where, you know, the control schemes might have been, or even in that case, just the camera thing, it's been different. And so it does kind of comport with what Jay's talking about in terms of it isn't necessarily bad, but it doesn't work the way that people think it should because they've got expectations from GameCube or from 360 that, you know, this is the way these things work. And then it's kind of affecting the experience for them, because it's confounding their expectations, even though it might not necessarily be bad. Then there's the other class where, you know, it is kind of bad. Like, the obvious example would be DKC Returns with the roll. There's no forgiving that one. It's just dumb. And there, I'm sure that you could point to many, many other examples with Wii as well. Well, I think that's going to do it for us. So this week's batch of listener mail, a good bunch. We managed to fit in quite a few letters there, but we didn't get to them all. But of course, we do also want more. So as I said earlier, get those in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I'm sure we'll have another mail segment in the not too distant future. But that's going to do it for this week's show. So a few usual reminders to check out Radio Trivia podcast edition that Guillaume, you were on quite recently.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And it's easier to get a word in with TYP.
I always love Radio Trivia. It was a good, a very enjoyable episode. Of course, it's connectivity as well. And we should mention, of course, the Negative World podcast as you're here, Guillaume. Have you anything in particular to say to our listeners about it?
I don't know if I did a great job describing it last time, but listen to it. It's good fun. It's very community oriented, though. So like people just pick a topic that they want to discuss and they just go with it. And it alternates between myself and Steven for the hosting and editing. So, you know, it's not always me talking, so don't be afraid to go check it out then.
Very modest again. And so, of course, don't forget as well, iTunes, rate and review us there. I think we're still not quite over the 200 barrier on the US store. Could be you. You could be the person that takes us 200.
And I will come to your house, and I won't.
You come to the house and do an in-person performance of Mappy the Audio Adventure.
Oh, no! So
James will give you a free day of crisis.
Any day with me is a day of crisis.
Johnny should be back to return us to normalcy next week. And, of course, 2 weeks from now, it'll be PAX East, and Guillaume will be there with the rest of the guys. So I'm looking forward to hearing that. But for this week, that's all. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye, everyone.